Welcome to the Danilo Husarstruk Memorial Lecture.
It is a great pleasure to have you all here today. I want to acknowledge in particular the presence of members of the Struk and Husar family. We're always grateful for their presence. I also want to acknowledge the presence and the participation in this event of members of the Canadian Association of Slavists. The Danilo Husarstruk Memorial Lecture was instituted after the death of my colleague Danilo Struk in 1999, and this is the third Struk Memorial Lecture we have held. The lecture honors an individual of considerable achievement. Danilo Struk, as most of you know, was a very prominent member of the Ukrainian scholarly community. He was, as most people know, the editor-in-chief of the large Encyclopedia of Ukraine project. But he was also an avid student, scholar, and teacher of Ukrainian literature, and it's particularly in that capacity that we honor him at this lecture. Tonight's speaker is a very appropriate speaker, since he was one of Danilo's colleagues in our series of literary adventures here in North America. And for many years, the threesome, Danilo, our speaker, and I, had a traveling road show on Ukrainian modernism, which we would do annually at the conference of the American Association of Slavic Studies. And so it's a very fitting memory to Danilo to have as today's speaker Professor Oleg Ienitsky of the University of Alberta, who is himself a prominent Ukrainianist, who is perhaps best known as the author of an important and groundbreaking study on Ukrainian futurism, who, as I've mentioned, is an author on questions relating to Ukrainian modernism and a great many other topics in Ukrainian literature, who is, as we will discover today, working in the area of the literature of the empire, and as we will discover a little later today, is also the compiler or co-compiler of a book that will be presented at a reception immediately after the lecture, which will be held in a room in this building, which I'll tell you more about at the end of the talk. And we will all enjoy the presentation of the four-volume concordance to the poetical works of Taras Shevchenko, which Professor Ienitsky has compiled. But today, we listen to his ideas, as I said, on the imperial theme, and I invite you to listen, and I invite him to read his talk entitled Deconstructing Gogol, Gogol's Two Souls.
Dobrý večer, good evening. Здравствуйте. Данило Струк was my friend and colleague, and it is indeed an honor for me to remember him this evening. I'd like to thank Maxim for the kind invitation to participate in this evening. As you probably, many of you may already know, this year marks the 150th anniversary of Nikolai Gogol's death. It seems, therefore, an opportune moment to re-examine the problem of his so-called two souls, i.e. his Ukrainian and or Russian identity, which has absorbed scholars for a long time and was an issue to which even Gogol was forced to respond personally. The subject seems doubly auspicious because of the current venue, the University of Toronto, the intellectual home of the late George Lutsky, who devoted two books to Gogol, both centrally related to the topic at hand. I will avoid burdening you with a long recapitulation of the literature on this topic, because a nice summary is available in Lutsky's 1998 book. To set a foundation for my own arguments, I will instead focus on a limited set of statements to suggest the range of opinions on this subject. Let me begin with N. Piksanov, who in the early 1930s said that it would be proper to call Gogol a Ukrainian-Russian writer. 2 decades earlier, Dmitry Ovsyanniko-Kulikovsky described Gogol as neither Ukrainian nor Russian, but as he put it, an all-Russian. Не малорос, а общерус. He then added, the great all-Russian poet-artist, one of the founders of all-Russian literature, Gogol, naturally was an all-Russian, but he was an all-Russian on a Ukrainian foundation. Ovsyanniko-Kulikovsky went on to explain, the all-Russian national form, национальна форма, as a psychological phenomenon, should not be considered a variant of Great Russian. Ukrainian scholarship has had mixed feelings about claiming Gogol for Ukrainian literature. The populists in particular took issue with him for failing to live up to late 19th century and early 20th century notions of what it means to be a Ukrainian. Much, much later, George Lutsky saw Gogol essentially as an all-Russian writer. George Grabovich has argued that Gogol must be also seen as a Ukrainian writer. While the literature on Gogol's identity and his relationship to Ukraine is large and is actually growing, it is probably fair to say that for most Slavists, and especially Russianists, this is a marginal issue, largely because it is assumed that the answer is too obvious for serious discussion. Calling Gogol a Ukrainian writer is seen at best as a case of special pleading. Many lay readers were actually surprised to learn that Gogol was a Ukrainian and are totally oblivious that there may be a controversy. Some scholars consider the problem of Gogol's Ukrainian identity in relationship to Ukrainian culture the stuff of humor. Clarence Brown of Princeton University, writing soon after the collapse of the Soviet Union, expressed the hope that, quote, perhaps Ukrainians will feel sufficiently secure in the possession of their own state, their own language, and their own literature to cease claiming Nikolai Gogol as an ornament of their national literature, the national culture, excuse me. In general, whatever relativism might exist around the question tends to be resolved in favor of presenting Gogol as an unequivocally a Russian writer. Writing in 1999, Boris Gasparov of Columbia University omitted any reference to the literature on this topic, but declared nevertheless, and I quote, it would be futile to characterize Gogol as an ardent Ukrainian patriot, a champion of his land and people. Such a depiction of Gogol shares the fate of other officious portraits of the writer that view him, for example, as a critical realist or as a defender of the small man. To this, Gasparov adds, Gogol's romantic mythologization of his double national allegiance offers little to those who would like to see him a champion of Ukrainian history, language, and literature. Leaving aside for the moment the ahistorical and anachronistic expectations Gasparov places on Gogol, comments like his immediately beg to be countered by reference to Gogol's letters of the 1830s, which are permeated with sentiments that might at first glance be confused with Ukrainian nationalism. For example, when it looked that he was about to receive a professorship in Kyiv, Gogol writes to Maksimovich in December of 1833, yes, it will be great if you and I get the Kyiv chairs. We'll be able to do a lot of good. On March 6, 1834, Gogol writes to Streznevsky, revealing that a sense of duty is driving him to his historic works. I am very happy about everything that appears about our land, Нашим краем. And if I were to learn that at this minute someone is also preparing a history of Ukraine, Историю Украины, I would stop my publication until he could sell his book. At another point, he adds, I'm not seeking any monetary gain from the history of Ukraine. To Maksimovich, he confessed also, right now, I have undertaken a history of our one and only poor Ukraine, нашей единственной бедной Украины. And at another time, he stresses the necessity of publishing Ukrainian songs. We have to publish the songs without fail in Kyiv, he says. But when Maksimovich is slow in reacting to this urgent request, Gogol pleads with him. He says, quote, for the sake of everything that is ours, for the sake of our Ukraine, for the sake of the graves of our fathers, don't hold up the songs. Ради всего нашего, ради нашей Украины, ради отцовских могил, не сиди над книгами. Then he continues. Imagine, I too am thinking, let's go to Kyiv, to ancient, beautiful Kyiv. It is our city, not theirs, meaning Ukrainian, not Russian. Isn't that right? There are in its vicinity, events of our past took place. One can rejuvenate all one's powers there. But I'm saddened if this does not come to pass. Not to have someone with whom one can speak in the language of one's soul is terrible. Языком души, as he puts it. Given the central place of Kyiv, that Kyiv occupied in 19th century Ukrainian and Russian national myth-making, Gogol's pithy statement is quite revealing. The point here is not to exaggerate Gogol's patriotism or his desire to serve his native land, but to underscore that such sentiments deserve at least equal status with other facts and should enter into a holistic and complex understanding of both the man and the writer. At minimum, such facts alert us that Gogol's national consciousness was not insignificant. It was not socially or politically functional, the way identity would become later. But then again, not many Ukrainians or Russians could boast of a self-awareness that was necessarily more sophisticated during this period. Despite signals of the type I have just mentioned, the general tendency of the critical literature is to discount or to marginalize the Ukrainian question. Kasparov, for example, like critics before him, buttresses his contention that Gogol is an essentially Russian writer by saying that, quote, Mirgorod, quote, marks that point where Gogol departs from his Ukrainian self-identification. Departs from his Ukrainian self-identification. As in the works of Sechkaryov, Ehrlich, Nabokov, and others, Ukraine is deemed a short-term infatuation, or as a regional fad, that gives way to Russian themes and hence to a Russian identity, which in turn serve as evidence that Gogol gives up Ukraine and his Ukrainian identity. The persistence of this form of argumentation is actually surprising, given that scholars as diverse as Piksanov and Fenger have shown that there is little chronological difference between the so-called Ukrainian and Petersburg tales, and the Ukrainian themes recur rather late in Gogol's creative life. His collected works, which appeared almost simultaneously with the publication of Dead Souls, included all his Ukrainian tales. The line of reasoning which insists on seeing some great divide in Gogol's work and identity would have us believe that Gogol became a great writer not through gradual maturity as an artist, but specifically through the embrace of Russian subjects. In this way, the creative agent is no longer Gogol the Ukrainian, but Russian culture. One problem with the notion that Gogol departs from his Ukrainian self-identification, sort of finally and irrevocably around 1835, in order to become a Russian, is that when asked nearly at the end of his career to define his nationality, he managed to profess only uncertainty. The avowal is made in a letter written December 24, 1844, to Alexandra Smirnova, described by Henri Troyat as, quote, the maid of honor to the empress, a graceful, cultivated, witty, sparkling girl who charmed all the best minds of the day. Scholarly references to this rather celebrated letter were made among others by Josef Mandelstam, Lutsky, and as most recently, Gasparov. It is here that Gogol tries to answer Smirnova's question about the nature of his nationality, his Ukrainian or Russian soul. The text is short, but it has been subject to a variety of readings. Mandelstam, for example, cites the letter in the context of discussing the impact of the Ukrainian language on Gogol's thinking and writing, drawing particular attention to the fact that Smirnova's question remains unanswered. Lutsky highlights the all-Russian character of the reply and points to another letter of October 24, 1844, where Gogol admitted to uniting within himself two natures, a Ukrainian and a Russian. For Lutsky, quote, there is no doubt that Gogol can be regarded as a product of an all-Russian culture. Kasparov makes the most far-reaching and unexpected deductions from the December letter, giving it a mystical and symbolic significance. According to him, the letter supports the idea that that Gogol, quote, envisions himself as being incarnated into Russia, end of quote. Kasparov continues, the idea of being born into an alien world of labor, frustration, and suffering evokes mystical associations with Adam's fall and the incarnation of Christ. This was acknowledged by Gogol in a letter to his longtime friend, Alexandra Spirneva. Kasparov then cites excerpts from Gogol's December 24th, 1844 letter in the following translation, his translation. I don't know, this is Gogol speaking, I don't know what sort of soul I have, that of a Chachol or that of a Russian. I know only that I would give preference neither to a little Russian over the Russian, nor the Russian over the little Russian. Both of their natures, природy, are too generously endowed by God, and as if intentionally, each of them, taken individually, contains that which is absent in the other, an obvious sign that they are meant to complement one another, so that later, having merged into one, they might constitute something most perfect in humanity. That's the end of the quote as given by Kasparov. Kasparov interprets these Gogol's words in the following way. He says, particularly noteworthy in this self-description, are the two natures reminiscent, especially in the context of a Christmas letter, of the two natures of Christ, as divine and human at the same time. The contradictory division and indivisible unity of the two natures of Christ corresponds to Gogol's perception of his own personality and mission as a writer. It is precisely this contradictory unity that contains the promise of exceeding one's ordinary limits and of achieving something, quote, most perfect in humanity. Kasparov then concludes, these are his words again, Gogol envisions himself as being incarnated into Russia so he can bring it his message of all-encompassing and all-redeeming truth. Kasparov's interpretation, with its stress on contradictory unity, recalls the all-Russian interpretation of Sanyiko Kulikovsky and Lutsky. But here the all-Russian, if you notice, simply becomes Russian, thus erasing the historically contingent identity embedded in that notion. But Kasparov's interpretation is problematical in other respects as well. The symbolic date of the writing notwithstanding, December 24th, it is simply impossible to see Gogol's letter, quote, as an acknowledgement of being born into an alien world of labor, frustration, and suffering, or as an evocation of mystical associations with Adam's fall and the incarnation of Christ. Quite the contrary. The letter is firmly rooted in social, not mystical reality, which is obvious from a preliminary sentence that Kasparov does not quote. And let me quote that for you. Gogol says, let me say a word concerning what kind of soul I have, Ukrainian or Russian, because as I see from your letter, this was at one time a subject of your discussions and arguments with others. From this, it is evident that Gogol is addressing the inquisitive queries of his contemporaries, not some spiritual question. The only self-description in the letter avows confusion about his own nationality. There is no evidence that he envisions himself as being incarnated into Russia. The really significant aspect of the letter is that, having been given an ideal opportunity to proclaim himself a Russian, Gogol actually shies away from making a specific declaration. Let's recall that this happens on the eve of 1845, when for all practical purposes, Gogol was at the end of his literary career and was recognized as the undisputed leader of Russian letters. Oddly, while at the pinnacle of his vocation, Gogol proclaims indecisiveness about his nationality, while at the same time affirming the equality of the two nationalities, both of which figure as distinct entities in his mind. This, in my view, should raise serious doubts about any categorical statements concerning Gogol's Russianness. In that respect, he clearly is not a full-fledged Russian writer, namely one that naturally fits into the same national subset as Pushkin, Dostoevsky, or Tolstoy, because none of the latter betray Gogol's national dilemma. Kasparov implies that the letter to Smirnova is about the nature of Gogol's soul. He seems to read the following sentence as if it included the bracketed word soul. I will reread the sentence I read to you before. I know only that I would give preference neither to the little Russian soul over the Russian soul, nor the Russian soul over the little Russian soul. So from here we come to the concept of incarnation and the analogies to Christ. In actual fact, however, Gogol is not speaking about the dual nature of his soul, for he has already declared that he does not know the type of soul he has, but about two distinct social or national types or temperaments. That is my preferred translation of priroda, which later in the letter becomes charakter. In other words, he is outlining differences between Ukrainians and Russians. His actual words to Smirnova were as follows. I only know that in no way would I give preference either to a Ukrainian person, i.e. malorossiyaninu, over a Russian, ruskomu, or a Russian over a Ukrainian. So clearly he's talking about individuals and not the nature of his soul. Given this, the notion that Smirnova's letter is evidence of Gogol's incarnation as a Russian, even symbolically, is highly implausible. Gogol even adds, towards the end of the letter, do not base yourself on my works and don't use them to come to any conclusions about me personally. Moreover, after the initial sentence about himself, Gogol's discourse moves into a plainly social dimension. He speaks of Ukrainians and Russians in a historical, not a mystical plane. For example, he says, both their temperament, priroda, are too generously endowed by God, and as if intentionally, each of them individually contains that which is missing in the other, a clear sign that they are meant to reinforce, пополнить, one another. For this reason, the very histories, notice he's now beginning to talk about histories, the very histories of their past existence were different, so that they might cultivate the different strengths of their character, charakterov, in order that later, having merged together, they might represent something most perfect in humanity. Now, this perfection of humanity is not incarnated Gogol, but I would argue this is a social polity. The last sentence stresses social and cultural equality between Ukrainians and Russians in the imperial state. The recognition of ethnic differences as strengths suggest that this letter is not an intimation of a merger of Gogol's two souls, but the anticipation of potential unity of two peoples for the purpose of creating a more perfect state or empire. At first glance, two of the strongest arguments in favor of Gogol as a straightforward Russian writer comes down to the language of his works and the Russian readership for which they were presumably intended, sometimes exclusively, it said. These arguments are often implicit in the interpretations of Gogol as a Russian, but occasionally they are also given an explicit articulation, as in the case of Kasparov, who states, quote, Gogol nevertheless always wanted to write about little Russians in Russia for the moral benefit of Russian society and the state. While this statement is essentially true, much rides on what we mean by Russian society and state. Kasparov clearly imagines a Russian national society and readership and attributes to the Russian language, specifically Russian national attributes. The problem, of course, is that the Russian language was the lingua franca of an empire, not of a national Russian state. Ukrainian educated society used Russian as its own literary medium and was just as likely to be Gogol's audience as ethnic Russians. Given the minuscule readership during this time, a periodical circulation of 5,000 was considered astronomical, 5,000. And Gogol's works were published in numbers of two. His Dead Souls appeared in 2,500 copies, and it took over 2 years to sell those 2,500 copies before the second edition was brought up. So given the minuscule readership and the multi-ethnic composition of the imperial intelligentsia, the notion that Gogol was oriented solely toward Russian national addressees appears highly unlikely. In fact, the fundamental weakness of most of the writings on Gogol, whether it is the outburst of a Clarence Brown or Donald Feinger's wonderful book, The Creation of Nikolai Gogol, is that they all treat Gogol as a Russian national writer without ever answering the what Russian nationality and culture were throughout this period, never mind how it was formed. Such concepts as Russian society and state, Russian national culture, Russian identity, are neither historicized nor problematized by literary historians. Yet we know from the current crisis of Russian identity, as well as from the now oft-repeated assertions by scholars of the Russian Empire, that the empire had a detrimental impact on Russian national development. Hence, any unproblematic approach to Russianist must be viewed with extreme skepticism, especially during Gogol's time, as I said. I think it is generally unappreciated that there are cultural consequences to admitting that Russia was an imperial state. And these consequences existed for both Ukrainians and Russians. In most instances, however, the culture of this pre-modern, multi-ethnic, multicultural polity is presented as if it was equivalent to a Russian national culture. And the empire becomes totally incidental to analyses of both Russian and Ukrainian national cultures. Brown, Gasparov, and Fanger, the examples to which I am limiting myself, conflate Russian national and Russian imperial culture quite unconsciously. But the celebrated historian Nicholas Ryasanovsky illustrates this tendency overtly. He writes, I quote, "Until 1991, Russia never had a national stage in its history. Nevertheless," he continues, "I repeat, there were national literature, music, architecture, and thinkers, but the government and state, as well as the bulk of the population, still belong to the old world, not the modern nationalism, not to modern nationalism." On brief reflection, this must strike us as a rather incompatible combination of assertions. On the one hand, Russia is acknowledged to be an imperial state without a national history. On the other, we are told that it possesses a national culture. I don't deny that. But the link between the imperial state and the national culture remains unexplained. In fact, the two seem entirely disconnected. When and how did Russian national culture appear in the empire? How did the Russians arrive at a national culture with a poorly developed national consciousness? Did the empire have a culture if the Russians had a national culture? And how does one square Ryasanovsky's position with the following statements by Trubetskoy? Quote, No one would exclude Gogol from Russian literature, Kostomarov from Russian historiography, Potebnya from Russian philology. Or how do we explain this sentence by Lihachev? Quote, Russian culture is meaningless without Ukrainian, as Ukrainian is without Russian. Yosif Mandelstam, in his highly respected book O charaktere Gogolevskogo styla, describes the culture created by Ukrainians and Russians in the empire as a common treasure house. The metaphor is apt, but it is clear from the statements I quoted by Trubetskoy and Lihachev, not to mention Gasparov, that a prescriptive discourse controls the management of this shared cultural capital, limiting any Ukrainian claims that go beyond the all-Russian notion. Nearly everyone who admits to the Ukrainian aspects of so-called Russian culture also insists that these Ukrainian components must be conceptualized on Russian national terms, and that they cannot have any reciprocal bearing on Ukrainian cultural existence. In this way, all high manifestations of civilization in the empire, regardless of the nationality of the author, are made congruent with Russian culture and exempted from Ukrainian consideration. Whether Gogol is defined a Ukrainian or a Russian writer, therefore, depends largely on how we conceptualize culture in the empire. If all high imperial culture in Russia is Russian national culture, then Gogol is a Russian writer. But if we accept a more reasonable position, namely that there were national societies in the empire other than the Russian, and that these societies led cultural lives through the mediation of imperial institutions, I would emphasize that, through the mediation of imperial institutions, then Gogol clearly belongs in the Ukrainian camp. He does so because his work, his biography, and career epitomize the typical Ukrainian adaptability to imperial existence, not to mention the ambivalences and contradictions involved in such a life. I believe that we can explain much about Gogol and the two respective national cultures with which he became connected if we recognize the empire as a cultural category and treat cultural activity within this multi-ethnic pre-modern society as the common cosmopolitan expression of ethnic intelligentsias who would only gradually move toward experimenting with competing models of nationality. To recognize the empire as a cultural category means abandoning the popular but misleading all-Russian concept, the banner under which Gogol is ushered into Russian national culture. My proposed category of imperial culture is an analytic concept. The all-Russian view is an imperial ideology. The latter states that all Eastern Slavs comprise a single Russian nation and nationality, a position that helped validate the autocratic, later totalitarian state on this territory. The incorporation of Ukraine into the Russian national imagination, both by government and educated elites, served imperial needs, helping to rationalize the heterogeneous state. There is no doubt that many Ukrainians of the period supported an all-Russian, but I would argue not a Russian state, and Gogol was one of them. An equal Slavic partnership appealed to such major Ukrainian literary figures as Pantelimon Kulish, Gogol's first biographer, and the concept of an elite Russian language, all-Russian culture, found sympathy even as late as the 1870s in the writings of Mikhailo Drahomanov. Gogol was committed to and concerned with a state, an empire, which forever remained in his imagination a mysterious and nationally elusive entity. He saw Ukraine and himself as part of the imperial state structures, and he successfully interjected both his homeland and his person into this imperial discourse. While the old Russian idea was clearly powerful, and for a brief time in history had the potential of creating a state-sponsored nationality comprising of Ukrainians and Russians, it came apart under the pressure of Ukrainian and Russian nationalism, both of which proved to be far more attractive. Under imperial influence, the all-Russian idea took on a secondary life as a tool of Russian national construction, shaping Russian consciousness from Belinsky to Solzhenitsyn. This all-Russian scheme also masquerades as a normative model of Slavic scholarship, which dominates the understanding, description, and attribution of cultural artifacts among the Eastern Slavs. This may explain why most readers and many scholars imagine Gogol only as a Russian. By moving away from the all-Russian ideology to the concept of an imperial culture, we can more plainly see that during Gogol's life, cultural production took place not in two autonomous cultures, the Ukrainian and Russian, but in a public sphere made up of intellectuals of various ethnic backgrounds, for all practical purposes comprised an estate that shared a common culture whose production and consumption was centered in the capitals and the major cities of the empire. It was in these imperial urban centers that Ukrainian vernacular culture would have its beginning, mainly in St. Petersburg. It was also among the intellectuals of the empire that the Russian and Ukrainian national movements arose, destroying the commonality of the imperial culture and eventually, I would argue, the integrity of the imperial state. While literary historians place Ukrainian and Russian culture in opposition and speak of the two as if they were self-evident categories, the fact is that during Gogol's lifetime, national selfhood and culture were only fledgling entities within imperial structures. And this goes for Ukrainians as it does for Russians. Gogol's letter of 1844 says something not only about the confusing hybrid status of his own national consciousness, but also about the provisional nature of national identity generally in the Russian Empire. The ability to differentiate between imperial and national categories in Russian imperial history is a significant moment in the study of Ukrainian-Russian cultural relations in that it puts both nations on a more equal conceptual footing. We can clearly see that nation building was not just a Ukrainian project at the beginning of the 19th century, but a Russian one as well. As a result, Gogol does not come out of, quote, a Russian culture, but an imperial setting, a public sphere in which Ukrainians and Russian elites had been socializing since at least the 17th century. Gogol appeared in imperial culture at the dawning of a new Russian literature. National literature, and at the apex of an old cycle of Ukrainian cultural development that is associated with such names as Polotsky, Yavorsky, Prokopovich, Skovoroda, Kapnis, Somov, to name only a few. This old Ukrainian culture is characterized by the integration of Ukrainian elites into the empire, but not without frequent notes of local Ukrainian patriotism. Gogol brings this tradition to an end, not on the ecclesiastical and classicist foundations of his predecessors, but by adding to it the more current romantic trends in Ukrainian society, namely a concern for folklore and history. In keeping with the practice of the Ukrainian elite families like the Troshchinskys, Gogol adopts the capitals of the empire as the setting for his career. In summary, I would say the following. Gogol is a Ukrainian Russian language writer who, through the mediation of the empire, had a tremendous impact on Russian literature. If Gogol is also a Russian writer, then he is one in the same way the Irishman James Joyce and Samuel Beckett are English writers, or the way the Spaniard Picasso is a French painter. That is to say, Gogol is a figure that has become, through the force of historical circumstances and personal genius, indispensable in two cultures, and logically belongs in two national histories, The revolution in Gogol scholarship is not really about recognizing Gogol as a Ukrainian. That is self-evident and undeniable. But in recognizing the outdated cultural modeling system that erases identities of whole societies under conditions of empire. When this transformation will occur, then Gogol will continue to hold an honored place in Russian literature as a Ukrainian writer, much as Picasso holds a preeminent place in the history of French art as a Spanish painter. Thank you very much.